This is Phil Farron. Excuse me. This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. Okay, had a little snack. My throat was a little clogged up. I should have cleared it before I started. Anyways, it's been a good week. The weird saga continues with the eating stuff. I of course am getting more YouTube videos in my list having to do with the carnivore diet, etc., which is to be expected. But the more I watch people talking about this, the more fascinating this becomes. Honestly, this is just crazy. I mean, I've seen people that have been on the carnivore diet for like 12 years, 6 years, 5 years. I have a buddy I go to breakfast with. He and his wife have been on it for 6 months. They're perfectly fine. And you get into these really weird things where, like, there's a medical doctor and he's talking about the carnivore diet. And he's talking about bacon. And he's saying, look, there's nothing wrong with bacon. It's got good fats in it. It's got good protein. He goes down to all the vitamins and minerals that it has in it. And he said, well, people say, well, it's got too much salt. It's got too much salt. And he said, that salt is not going to hurt you. And, well, it's got nitrates in it. And according to him, our saliva has like 25 times, if I got it right, has like 25 times the amount of nitrates in it that bacon has. He said, there's nothing wrong with nitrates either. He says, you can eat as much bacon as you want. This is just crazy. So, five and a half weeks ago, when I started paying more attention to this, 5.5 weeks ago, I was 180 pounds. I stepped on the scale this morning, I was 163.1. So, I mean, I have lost whatever that is, 163. So it's like 17. Is that right? 17 pounds. It is right. In about 5.5 weeks. Eating meat, including salami, spam, bacon, sardines. That's meat, of course, too. Steaks. I have had some chicken and some pork, but it's been a lot of beef. Everything cooked in butter. And a lot. I mean, like, after I fasted from Sunday to Tuesday morning, and I've did fast till Tuesday evening, but Tuesday morning I was 165. Tuesday evening, I had a can of sardines. I made myself a steak. I had 6 eggs with butter. I had 2 pieces of beef liver. Did I eat anything else? It was enough food that when I started getting down to the bottom of my bowl, I was done. I just had so much food. I was just like, oh, I'm done. So that was around 7:30 Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, I got up, went for my little run, came home. I was still 165. I don't know how you eat all that stuff and you end up the same weight. Because normally when I tank up on a big salad, I mean, the next day, there is no question, I am up 2-3 pounds. So that was Wednesday morning, I was 165. This morning, I was 163. So I'm just, now that I know that theoretically nitrates aren't bad for me, I went by the store just before I dropped off at church to help set up the sound, and I got myself a 1/2 pound of roast beef, and I got myself a 1/2 pound of pepperoni, and I bought myself a pack of pre-cooked bacon, which has like 20 pieces in it. And I would just imagine I'm going to clean through most of that tonight. I also have a pound of ground beef at home that I'm going to cook up. And I'll probably make myself 5 or 6 eggs. And that will be my supper. Oh, and I'll have a can of sardines, too. I'm going to keep doing this for like one more week, and then I might start layering in some other stuff. Oh, and I bought goat cheese. Bought some goat cheese this week. Tried a couple of spoonfuls of that Tuesday night. That was good. Goat cheese is fine. I also found out this week that supposedly cottage cheese is not good. Cream cheese. The cream cheese is fine because there's no carbs in it. Like, are you kidding me? I can have cream cheese? This is crazy. I don't know. So I think I am going to get some blue cheese as well. And start sprinkling that on stuff because that's got some kick to it. Gonna layer in some goat cheese. Get some cheddar cheese in. I'm below where I wanted to be at this point. So, I mean, I can splurge a little. And I'm just gonna see what happens until next weekend. Next weekend is National Nude Day. So I wanted to be a little slimmer anyways because it's a full body suit. You know, that bodysuit is unforgiving. And so I wanted to do that, and we'll see what happens from there. I will probably layer in some greens, but I'll layer in some cheese first and see how that goes and see if that does anything as far as weight gain goes. And then I'll probably just layer in greens, collard flour, or collard greens and kale, see how that goes. And I really think I can live on this. I mean, it's just fine. And especially with everything that's happening with grains in this country, between the genetically modified grains, so they can just carpet bomb everything with Roundup, and you've got that residue on that, you know. Plus the fact that you don't really need carbs. You can live just fine without carbs. It doesn't give you anything besides sugar. Do some of that, and who knows, I may layer in the athletic greens like I mentioned before, because the athletic greens people do seem to go out of their way to actually put together a good combination of stuff, including some mushrooms and things like that, and they do have their stuff tested. So anyways, that's that. Costumes are fine. I had to rebuild a non-trivial amount of stuff with paper bag day because it was just getting long in the tooth. So I've got that rebuilt. I may have one or two little things I'm going to do today or on it this evening. But I think I'm pretty well ready to go for paper bag day, which is always an interesting adventure because it's a fairly large costume and it's made out of paper. So I haven't checked the weather yet. Hopefully I'm not going to get rained on because that would be bad. So that's, no, we don't need to answer a phone call from a marketer. So that's all good. Writing is going fine. I'm a little bit ahead this week, which is good because on Saturday, Maranatha Village has asked me, they're having a 50-year celebration of Maranatha Village for the workers. They've invited them all out. The CEO said, hey, would you mind coming by in costume? And so paper bag day isn't the greatest costume for that type of celebration. So I asked them last week when I was there, because I had the Uncle Sam get up on, and I said, hey, do you want me just to throw this back on next Saturday? And they said, yeah, do this. So I'm going to do paper bag day on Saturday and then go back to my mother-in-law's. Maybe do a little bit of reading there or writing. And then I'm going to throw on the Uncle Sam costume and go to the Maranatha celebration, say hello to people for a half hour or so, and then, you know, I'll take on out of there and come home and finish up my writing for the day. So, all is well. Things are going fine at work. We got all our harvest done for this month, and we'll be closing on Monday. So, you know, that's all fine. I think I mentioned last week that I had been listening to this book, The Real Anthony Fauci, by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I may have mentioned this last week, but I just thought, you know, we really need to put things in context. Because one of the things that shocked me about the whole COVID thing was how rapidly all the forces seem to marshal to push towards one and only one conclusion. And I was confused for a time as to how everything could marshal that quickly. Because it was obviously a coordinated effort. Even before there was any big announcement about how we're going to push to get a vaccine up and we're going to go, you know, at warp speed to get this up and blah, 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 blah. Even before that, there were all these steps coming into play that these steps all pointed in the same direction. And the direction that they pointed was... Hold on. I've got a friend. He's telling me a joke. Hold on. Because this is going to be good. Because his jokes are always good. So, his jokes are, this better be good. Because it's on the podcast, Bill. What? Oh. Okay. I like it! Exclamation point. So the joke is, do you know why the pepper couldn't practice archery? He didn't have an arrow. Very nice. Okay, anyways. So... get back on track, Phil. Okay, so, what we saw in COVID was like this incredible focusing that even before there was an effort to say, yes, we're going after the vaccine and we're going to build a vaccine, even before that, there were steps being taken early on of suppressing certain types of information. And there's no question about that. You listen to somebody like Robert Malone and him talking about that he and his wife had put together this book of how to deal with a coronavirus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and they upload it to Amazon. And they upload it in February, and then they're getting ready to do an update to it like in March of 2020. I mean, this is right on the front edge. And Amazon says, you can't update that. We've taken that down. This was before all the cancel culture stuff started, but there was something about the fact they were trying to show people how to deal with coronavirus in a proactive way without needing any sophisticated drugs or anything like that. That was enough of a threat. That alone turned some levers of power, such that their book was taken down. And you hear these stories like this over and over, that like doctors were saying to their staff, I remember listening in May that doctors were talking about the fact, I heard one doctor talking about the fact that they had been told that the coronavirus was coming and his staff was really nervous, and he got his staff together and he said, look, we've dealt with respiratory viruses before. We don't know exactly what we're dealing with here, but we're gonna do the same thing we've always done. And that is, we're going to deal with this. We're going to treat symptoms. We're going to watch and see how this disease develops. We're going to do this. And he he got a call from like his doctor's association because he was starting to talk about it. And they were like, yeah, you can't do that. And he said, what? He's, no, wait, you know, we'll pull your license if you keep talking about this. So there was this effort that formed up really early on, very rapidly. And somehow, before there was even an announcement that they were going for a vaccine, somehow, even before that, everybody seemed to be on the same page within halls of power, that there was going to be no early treatment. There was going to be no preventative stuff. We were going to pin all of our hopes on a vaccine. And we were going to get that thing out as quickly as we could possibly get it out. And that was always a mystery to me. How in the world did this form up so quickly? I wasn't necessarily naive about the fact that pharmaceutical companies pretty much ran the FDA and the CDC and all those things. But everybody seemed to fall in lockstep so quickly. It was fascinating. It was just fascinating. And in listening to this book, The Real Anthony Fauci, if there's one huge takeaway from it, it is that all of this stuff has been done multiple times already. And the only reason we haven't paid more attention to it is because the health crisis wasn't larger. Because apparently they tried to do with this with the MERS virus. They tried to do it with SARS. You know, they've been trying to do it with bird flu. But none of that stuff has really made an impact like COVID did. When COVID started rapidly spreading across the world and it was actually infectious and there were big questions about how lethal it was, all this machinery was in place and ready to go. And we know that because the exact same machinery was in place during the AIDS crisis. And if The Real Anthony Fauci book does anything, it absolutely establishes that all of the mechanisms, deny any preventative treatment, deny any early care, ridicule anyone who disagrees with you, limit funding to expensive new drugs, stack all the review committees, pull all sorts of shenanigans during trials, all of those things are exactly what happened in the AIDS epidemic. And the atrocities of treating human life in such a casual manner happened in the AIDS epidemic as well. Instead of quoting from The Real Anthony Fauci book, however, I just wanted to see, because over and 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 over in the book, what Robert F. Kennedy writes about is he quotes articles. I mean, it's just one right after another. All the research that was done, he quotes this huge amount of articles that were written at the time about what was going on with AIDS and AIDS research and HIV and the HIV, AZT, the supposed HIV vaccine, that was all that stuff, treatments. And so I just thought, well, this is a horrible story. Let's go see if this story is actually out there. And in fact, everything that I've looked up, which I haven't looked up a ton of stuff, but everything I've looked up is easily findable on Google. So this particular story was not about AZT, which was the first thing that got approved for HIV and AIDS treatment, even though it was toxic, even though in at least one of the trials, the private investigators faked the numbers because they were giving people in the trial with AZT five times the number of blood transfusions that they were giving to the control group to keep the people in on AZT alive so they could say, no, there was not really any side effects at all of giving people AZT, which was just a bull. It was just a bald-faced lie. And then they could say, no, it's safe and effective. They kept saying that about the AZT and the AIDS drugs. They're safe and effective. And I thought, well, that sounds familiar. Anyway, so here's a terrible story. I'll just give you the overview. This came out of Harper's Magazine. It was written by Celia Farber, I think is her name, Celia Farber. And she was reporting on a woman named Joyce Ann Hafford. She said Joyce Ann Hafford was a single mother living alone with her 13-year-old son, Jamal, in Memphis, Tennessee, when she learned she was pregnant with her second child. She worked as a customer service representative at a company called CMC Call Center. Her son was a top student, an athlete, and musician. In April of 2003, note the date, this is April 2003. This is two decades ago. In April 2003, Hafford, 4 months pregnant, was urged by her obstetrician to take an HIV test. She agreed, even though she was healthy and had no reason to think that she might be HIV positive. The test result came up positive, though Hafford was only tested once, and she did not know that pregnancy itself can cause a false positive HIV test. Her first thought was of her unborn baby. Hafford was immediately referred to an HIV AIDS specialist, Dr. Edwin Thorpe, who happened to be one of the principal investigators recruiting patients for a clinical trial at the University of Tennessee Medical Group that was sponsored by the Division of AIDS, the chief branch of HIV AIDS research within the National Institutes of Health. So, let's review. It was known that pregnant women could test positive for AIDS when they or test positive for HIV when they didn't have HIV. And the only way to know for sure was to administer multiple tests. This was known. She took one test, and on the basis of that positive indication, she was recommended to a trial to test a new AIDS HIV vaccine. Actually, this particular drug was supposedly, you'd take this drug and it would keep you from giving HIV to your baby. So the vultures descended on this woman. As soon as they knew she had tested positive, they didn't tell her, oh, you know what, we should really take a couple of more tests. Just make sure it wasn't a false positive. Go from there. So they vultures descend on her and convince her that she should go ahead and enroll for this trial because this would save her baby from having HIV. So, of course, she does it. So, Joyce Ann Hafford was 33 years old and had always been healthy. She showed no signs of any of the clinical markers associated with AIDS. Her CD4 counts, whatever those are, which measures the lymphocytes that are used to indicate how strong a person's immune system is, and which HIV is believed to slowly corrode, were in the normal range, and she felt fine. In early June 2003, she was enrolled in the trial. And on June 18th, she took her first doses of the drug. So this was a regimen, they've got it here someplace, that included nevirapine and a couple other cocktails. And this was, it was a safety trial called the PACTG 1022. And they were trying to determine if there was efficacy to keep babies from getting HIV from their mothers. So in June 2003, she was enrolled in the trial, and on June 18th, she took her first doses of the drug. Quote, "She felt very sick right away," recalls her older sister, Ruby King. Within 72 hours, she had a very bad rash, welts all over her face and hands and arms. This was the first sign there was a problem. I told her to call her doctor, and she did, but they just told her to put on hydrocortisone cream on it. I later learned that this rash is a very bad sign, but they didn't seem alarmed at all. Hafford was on the drug regimen for 38 days. Her health started to deteriorate from the moment she went on the drugs, King said. She was always in pain, constantly throwing up, and finally got to the place where all she could do was lie down. The sisters kept the news of Halford's HIV test and the trial itself from their mother, and Halford herself attributed her sickness and nausea to being pregnant. She was a cheerful person, a non-complainer, and was convinced that she was lucky to have gotten into the trial. She said to me, "Neil," that's what she called me, "I've got to get through this. I can't let my baby get this virus." I said, "Well, I understand that, but you're awful sick." But she never expressed any fear because she thought this was going to keep her baby from being HIV positive. She didn't even know she was in trouble. So she goes on. She keeps taking the drugs. And they cause a whole host of problems. And finally, on July 25th, Halford was summoned back to the hospital after her lab reports from 9 days earlier were finally reviewed. She was admitted to the hospital's ICU with acute and subacute necrosis of the liver, secondary to drug toxicity, acute renal failure, anemia, septicemia, premature separation of the placenta, and threatened premature labor. She was finally taken off the drugs, but was already losing consciousness. Halford's baby, Sterling, was delivered by C-section on July 29th, and she remained conscious long enough not to hold him, but at least to see him and learn that she had a boy. The sister said, "We joked about it a little when she was coming in and out of consciousness in ICU. I said to her, 'You talked about me so much when you were pregnant that the baby looks just like me.'" Halford's last words were a request to be put on a breathing tube. She thought that a breathing tube might help her, says Ruby. "That was the last conversation I had with my sister. In the early morning hours of August the 1st, Ruby and her mother got a call to come to the hospital because doctors had lost Halford's pulse. Jamal was sleeping. Ruby woke up her own daughter, instructed her not to tell Jamal anything. They went to the hospital and had been there about 10 minutes when Joyce Ann died. Ruby recalls the hospital staff said they would clean her up and let them sit with her. She also remembered a doctor who asked for their home phone numbers and muttered, "You've got a lawsuit." That person has not resurfaced. They hadn't been sitting in Halford's body long when a hospital official came in and asked the family whether or not they wanted an autopsy performed. "We said, 'Yes, sure we do,' they said. And the hospital official said it would be at their expense, at a cost of $3,000. We said, 'We don't have $3,000. My sister didn't have any life insurance or anything. She had state health insurance coverage, and we were already worried about how to get the money to bury her. Consequently, no autopsy was done. There was a liver biopsy, however, which revealed that according to internal communiques of the DAID staff, that Halford had died of liver failure brought on by the nevirapine toxicity. And that was what the family was told. And what was the family told about the cause of Halford's death? So the liver toxicity showed that it was because of the treatment. How did they put it? Ruby answers carefully. "They told us how safe the drug was. They never attributed her death to the drug itself, after all. They said her disease, AIDS, must have progressed rapidly. But Joyce Ann Halford never had AIDS or anything even on the diagnostic scale for AIDS. I told my mom when we were walking out of there that morning," Ruby recalls. "I said, 'Something is wrong.' She said, 'What do you mean?' I said, 'On the one hand, they're telling us this drug is safe, and on the other hand, they're telling us they're going to monitor the other patients more closely. If her disease was progressing, they should have changed her medication. I knew something was wrong with their story, but I just couldn't put my finger on it. So the other thing that was interesting is Ruby King made a final disturbing, disgusting, and I'm jumping over a bunch of stuff. The article goes on a lot longer than this. Made a final disturbing discovery when she was going through Halford's medical records. In addition to rediscovering that her sister had only been given a single HIV test, she also came across a 15-page consent form, which was unsigned. So, according to that, they never had this woman's consent to start drugging her up with all these toxic chemicals. And what you see over and over in the book, The Real Anthony Fauci, is that this kind of thing, where there seems to be no concern for patients' life, where there seems to be no careful monitoring of things, it was going on in the late 80s and early 90s. And this was all part of an effort in 2003 because someone said, oh, well, mothers can give this to their children, so we need to develop a drug to stop that. And so they came up with something they thought might be a candidate, and then they just started putting it into trials, and it didn't matter that it was toxic and killing people. They just covered it up. So I've got this highlighted. I don't know why, but I've got this highlighted. A DAIDS project officer close to the HIVnet study closed the door when she had her first meeting with Fishbein. Fishbein was somebody who was trying to investigate this stuff and get it under control. She had also crossed over from the private sector, so she and Fishbein shared a delusionment over how much shoddier and chaotic the research culture was within the government compared to the industry. Quote, I'm really frightened about the stuff that goes on here, she told him. We really need somebody. This project officer, who for her own protection cannot be named, told Fishbein that the division's flagship study in Africa, HIVnet012, had been racked with problems and completely lacking in regulatory standards. I think that's the one where they were injecting children in Africa. And children were dying. She told Fishbein that the trial investigators were out of control, that there was no oversight over them, and nobody with either the inclination or the authority to make them adhere to safety standards. What Fishbein subsequently learned entangled him in a story that had eerie echoes of John le Carré's Constant Gardener. I mean, it's so, yes, Robert Kennedy Jr. goes on for, I don't know how long this book is. It was like a 24-hour listen, and I've still got 10 hours to go. Yes, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. can just sit there and quote article after article after article after article, but of course you don't know, is he hallucinating like ChatGPT? And what I've found is that when he quotes an article and I go look it up on Google, it's all sitting there. And it's talking about the graft and corruption and the money laundering and the mill and the unsafe practices and the populating committees that supposedly are looking out for the public health that are just lining their own pockets and approving stuff that shouldn't be approved. And all this was going on in the late 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s because AIDS was a significant crisis. And that meant you could get a significant amount of money attached to it. I mean, we're talking billions. And you had to produce something for all of that. And if you just needed to fudge the numbers and those type of things in order to produce something, then they just fudged the numbers. And they fudged the trials. And they put it out just like they did with the COVID-19 vaccines. Because there was billions and billions of dollars to be made. And this finally explains how everything formed up so quickly, and how from the beginning there seemed to be this understanding that, oh, this pandemic disease is heading this way, and this is how we're going to handle it. We're going to indemnify the drug companies. We're going to discourage any attempt to find any early treatments. We're going to discourage any attempt to repurpose drugs that are out of patent and we can't make any money on. We're going to condemn, we're going to vilify anyone who tries to tell us that this disease is not as dangerous or as lethal as it is. I've already talked about Jay Bhattacharya and how he did some really preliminary studies and showed that COVID-19 wasn't as nearly deadly as the company line, and he just got dumped on for that. Because it needed to be dangerous, because we have to rush these things through, because we have to have, you know, we're doing, you know, all this development at the speed of science. We have to get this out. And there could be no other solutions because they had to get an emergency authorization for it. Emergency use authorization, because that means they would be indemnified. And everything that happened in COVID-19 is just going by the playbook that has been in existence for decades. So that's pretty interesting. And I've mentioned the other thing that was really interesting that was mentioned in this book as well, and that is that Anthony Fauci was getting paid by the military. And that his NIAID was getting huge amounts of money from the military, because the military is not allowed to do biological weapons research. But if you call it gain-of-function research and you say, oh, well, this is so that we can develop vaccines quicker, so we can see what might happen with this virus so that we'll know how to deal with it. If you say that, then basically you can do your biological research, your biological weapons research, under the cover of that. And so the military is funneling money into Anthony Fauci's coffers so that Anthony Fauci then gets a cut of that and he gets a bounce in his salary. That's the reason that he was the highest paid government official beyond even what the president gets paid. And it's all just this huge machine that has one solution to everything. When there's a problem, we're going to develop a vaccine. And it doesn't really matter if that vaccine is toxic. It doesn't really matter if that vaccine causes horrible side effects. I was just watching a video on a new report that comes out that apparently the quality control on these vaccines was just horrible. And in some of the batches, they were hot batches, in some of those batches, those batches were causing significant vaccine injuries in 1 in 20 people who received them. And even the normal batches were causing significant vaccine injuries in 1 in 1,000, which is way higher than it should be. But the government gave these drug companies billions of dollars to develop these vaccines, and they bought hundreds of millions of doses of them. And then they started telling everybody, you need to take this. And then when some people were hesitant, they started going into, you better take this or we're going to mandate it. And then companies started mandating it, because this is what has to be done. And before this thing even started, there was a playbook ready to go, because that's what they've been doing for decades. It's a fascinating world. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.